volcanic ash is delaying flights all over Northern Europe.
This is not a headline from last year.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for checking out the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, May 24th.
Coming up, billions in stimulus money went to firms that had a little problem paying taxes.
Washington tries again for a deal on the debt.
And how culture can make men happy and healthy.
All that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
Now to that volcano that's erupting in Iceland, the one that no one can pronounce, another volcano no one can pronounce, and the havoc it is wreaking on some of the busiest airspace in the world. British authorities say 500 flights could be affected today.
And that means thousands of travelers could be delayed and millions of dollars could be lost by the airlines. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from London with more. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, I guess the big question is, will this year's ash cloud be as bad as last year's?
Well, last year was bad, remember. 10 million passengers were stranded. The airlines paid out $1.7 billion in compensation. But there's reason to think that it's not going to be anything like as bad this time. In fact, the UK Weather Office has just said that the worst of this ash cloud is over. And there's another reason for optimism. Last year, for example, the UK grounded aircraft as soon as any ash was detected in the atmosphere. That, says UK Transport Secretary Philip Hammond, won't happen this time.
There will be no blanket closures of airspace. Airlines are now able to fly in low and medium ash density conditions, which they weren't able to last year.
Stephen, last year the airlines didn't really like the government response to the ash cloud. Do they feel it's better this time around?
Well, better marginally, but they're still not happy, or at least their lobby group, IATA, is not happy. It's complained that the UK government doesn't have its own light aircraft that can go up and test the ash density to see whether it's safe to fly. The UK is relying solely on the forecasts of its National Weather Service. IATA says that is astonishing and unacceptable.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
President Obama continues on his trip to the UK ahead of his plans to attend the big summit of the world's Group of Eight economic powers in France later this week, on Thursday to be specific. But before that meeting gets underway, there is an international summit in Paris today, bringing together world leaders and tech titans. So what does Facebook have to do with international policy? The BBC's Christian Fraser is with us now from Paris with the latest. Good morning, Christian.
Good morning.
So the Facebook CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, and other tech CEOs are there with the heads of state. Why are they there?
Well, it's the first time the voices of the big internet companies, the thinkers, the major players who build the internet will be heard at the highest level of world politics. The internet economy makes up around 6% of the world GDP. It's a huge business, but there's still this huge gap of incomprehension between the people in the technology industry, the techies, and the policymakers. They're two very different worlds. They often have a very hard time understanding each other. Nicolas Sarkozy, who is hosting the debate and speaking this morning, wants to get a feeling for what the industry is thinking and how policymakers might be able to help.
I know there's been tension before between world leaders and these tech leaders. How do you think that's going to play out?
The two views are this. There's that aspires by Google and Amazon, who want a hands-off approach to the industry. They want more favorable tax regimes and labor laws for the industry to help it grow. And then there's the alternative view adopted by many countries in Europe now of more regulation on things like privacy law, competition and copyright laws. And I think there is a lot of suspicion, not least because the man that is hosting the debate, President Sarkozy himself, is seen within Europe by many in the industry as a barrier to digital growth. He's introduced anti-piracy laws. He's proposed a levy to tax global internet companies. It's very different to the American approach. President Obama has underlined throughout that he wants more freedom. It underpins not only the American economy, but also it's fundamental to U.S. foreign policy.
The BBC's Christian Fraser in Paris. Christian, thanks.
Thank you.
Now let's get to oil and gas prices. They're down from their peak, but Goldman Sachs said today that oil prices will jump another 20% or so in the next 12 months. Julie Neiman is an analyst with Smith, Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, let's just set the scene. Oil prices are down from their peak. Gas prices are down from their peak, 11 cents down last week. Why the drop after the big run-up in prices?
Well, it's really the laws of supply and demand. We have plenty of supply and we have flat demand. The only reason we got to these astronomic prices was because of speculation. In fact, the president of Exxon said if prices only reflected supply and demand, we'd be at $70 a barrel. So speculation drove it up to those levels.
And what about this Goldman Sachs prediction this morning that oil prices and probably therefore gas prices will go up another 20% in the next 12 months?
Well, they're assuming very strong global growth, significant pickup in demand, and we're looking at across the globe. We're not all driving electric cars yet, so you're going to see significant pickup as we continue to recover very slowly here.
Well, if we're going to see significant pickup, Julie, have we reached the end of the $3 a gallon gasoline?
Well, we could plunge back down to $1.19 a gallon, sure, but that would take another huge honking recession depression, and that would bring the global economy to its knees. That's a measure that's just a tad draconian.
So $4 a gallon is what we're going to be paying going forward.
We could very well, with strong demand, and the fact is we still don't have fuel-efficient cars. We don't have a transportation infrastructure that helps out yet. It's going to take that to keep it under control.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much as always.
You bet.
Jeremy, Julie, China today appealed a World Trade Organization ruling saying the U.S. blatantly ignored international trade rules when it imposed trade barriers on car tires imported from China.
Microsoft has dropped to third place when it comes to the market value of tech companies. The software giant was edged out by IBM for the first time since 1996, and Apple is number one, by the way.
We've got more numbers, the Wall Street ones that go up and down, and a lot of other numbers as well at our website, marketplace.org.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
Vice President Joe Biden meets this afternoon with congressional leaders from both parties for the fourth time. They're trying to find a compromise to raise the government's debt limit. We hit that $14.3 trillion limit last week, though the Treasury Department is doing some fancy accounting work to buy a couple more months of negotiating time before a national default. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is with us now with more on this story. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Well, first, where do we stand on these negotiations going on?
Well, the Biden group has reportedly found some savings by agreeing to cut government contributions to employee pension accounts. But, you know, with 8 or 9 weeks still to go before the actual drop-dead default date, neither side seems to be negotiating in earnest yet. There's also that gang of five bipartisan senators still trying to come up with a compromise, despite losing one of their Republican members.
Yeah.
But there's not much sign of cooperation there. Maya McGuinness at the Committee for a Responsible Budget still thinks that they're the group most likely to come up with a long-lasting reform. Two entitlements, for example.
Without the gang of six or five or something like that, a bipartisan group that's really focused on fixing the entire problem, I think it will be harder to accomplish that very important task.
Harder to accomplish the task, John. It all sounds pretty depressing, I have to say. Not a lot of progress here.
Not only very little progress, the government may be about to dig the hole of debt even deeper. Even anti-spending Republicans acknowledge that there's going to have to be an extra spending bill sometime this summer to cover the additional government expenses for disaster relief. Could be another $1 billion.
For those tornadoes and floods that are going on. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. Thanks.
Thank you.
Also in Washington, the Government Accountability Office is out with a new report today on all the companies that got stimulus money from the Recovery Act that passed in 2009. A glaring part of that report is that a lot of those contracts, $24 billion worth, went to companies that owed millions of dollars in back taxes. More on that report now from Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
It says thousands of contractors on government stimulus projects owe hundreds of millions in back taxes. Steve Ellis of Taxpayers for Common Sense says that's just not fair.
You know, if you're going to stick your finger in Uncle Sam's eye and not pay your taxes like a good corporate citizen, then you shouldn't expect to be able to get contracts that are worth millions of dollars.
Contractors are now required to certify that they don't owe back taxes, but federal agencies can't check that with the IRS because of taxpayer privacy rules. Scott Amey is with the Project on Government Oversight. He says the IRS needs to share more taxpayer information with other agencies.
And by having some kind of overlap with the IRS would then provide a layer of insulation that the government knows that it is working with contractors that are all paid up on their taxes.
But the IRS has its own problems. It has also awarded contracts to companies that owe back taxes. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Toyota doesn't do a very good job of incorporating customer feedback into its cars. That's according to a panel the company set up last year after a long bout of safety recalls.
Well, it's been a tumultuous time for Toyota and perhaps an opportunity for American car companies to make inroads in Japan. Hans Greimel is Asia editor for Automotive News. He's with us now from Tokyo. Hi, Hans.
Hello.
Tell us about this U.S. government report and what it says about Toyota.
It's a rather in-depth look at Toyota, and it's taken after, of course, Toyota's big quality lapses, especially in 2010. And I think it points out a lot of steps that Toyota has made to improve on some of the problems that it had. But it also says that there's still room for improvement going forward.
It looks like, Hans, Ford is trying to take advantage of Toyota's weakness, though. I saw that the Ford Japan chief said he wants to sell more cars in the Japanese market. How unusual is that?
I think that Ford and the other American brands in Japan always want to sell more cars here, but they're starting from such a low percentage of the market that any improvement is going to have a very small impact. In January alone this year, Toyota sold more imports in Japan. In other words, Toyota brought in more cars from outside Japan and sold them in Japan than Ford, Cadillac, Jeep, Chevrolet, and Chrysler all combined. So the imports here really make up a small section of the market. So is there an opportunity for Ford to sell more cars in Japan? Yes. Will it have a big impact, even if it has an increase in sales? Probably not.
Hans Greimel, Asia editor for Automotive News, with us from Tokyo. Hans, thanks.
Thank you.
Back in this country now, the V in VW today stands for Volunteer State. Volkswagen opened up a new factory in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
The German automaker says its goal is to beat out Toyota and General Motors to become the world's number one car maker within the next 7 years. To do that, Volkswagen aims to triple its sales here in the U.S. And reporter Sally Herships tells us now the new plant fits right into that plan.
One of every 9 new cars sold globally last year was made by Volkswagen. But in the U.S., this major brand is a niche player, on par with Subaru. Part of the problem is it hasn't made cars in the country since the late 80s.
If you're going to be competitive, you generally have to build your cars where you sell your cars.
David Cole is chairman emeritus for the Center of Automotive Research. He says building a plant locally can help protect manufacturers from fluctuating exchange rates. And by choosing the South, Volkswagen joins other car makers looking for lower-cost auto workers. The plant is expected to crank out 150,000 cars a year, starting with the Passat. But the car's design has been tailored for American consumers.
It took German car makers a long time to understand that U.S. buyers wanted cup holders.
Bill Visnick is senior editor at AutoObserver.com. He says there are big differences between what European and American consumers want in a car.
First and foremost is interior size. Americans like cars that they feel like they can stretch out in a little bit inside.
Volkswagen says its American Passat is a few inches longer and wider than the German version and several thousand dollars cheaper. It will also have more cup holders, 8 for a car that seats 5 people. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
To Georgia now, where the shrimping industry is having a hard time passing on high fuel costs to consumers. And that, combined with increasing competition from abroad, is forcing some shrimpers to cut bait, Steve, and switch to jellyfish.
Oh!
They're catching them by the ton.
For eating?
Yes.
Oh.
Well, apparently they're very popular in Asia in salads and stir fries, and so they're shipping off the jellyfish to Asia. Disposing of the excess catch, though, can get a bit unpleasant.
I can imagine.
One resident of Darien, Georgia, where they've been taking all of the jellyfish that they don't need, I guess, and some other stuff that they've been catching along with it.
The excess jellyfish.
The excess stuff. They've been pouring it into a river in Darien, Georgia. And the one resident of Darien tells the Savannah Morning News the town hasn't smelled very nice for days.
Word today that sales of new single-family homes were up in April. It was a second month of sales gains, and prices increased too, according to the Commerce Department. But realtors certainly aren't popping much champagne. We're still on track for the worst year of new home sales in half a century.
But there is one kind of real estate that's on a tear, as Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
The price of farmland has been growing faster than corn in a hot July. Prices are up more than 20% this year in parts of the Midwest. In Nebraska, Farm Bureau President Keith Olson says his own land is worth three times what it was 5 years ago. Bidding wars are common.
Neighbors get the fighting between who should own that quarter in between them. A lot of farmers have cash right now, and they are buying land at a very high price.
Crop prices are up, so it's tempting to expand. Interest rates are low, so it's cheap to borrow. And both of these things could change. Economist Robert Shiller called the tech bust and the housing collapse before they happened.
People often ask me, where's the next bubble? It's possible that it could happen in farmland.
But there are also real reasons for rising prices. The amount of farmland is essentially fixed, while the population keeps getting bigger and hungrier. And farmer Keith Olson says new technologies make his dry western Nebraska acres more productive and more valuable every year. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
It's quiz time here on the Marketplace Morning Report, and the subject today is gas prices. Stefan Richter is our quiz master. He's editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy. Ready for today's quiz?
I'm ready.
So which of the following countries has the highest gasoline prices? Is it A, the United States, B, Saudi Arabia, C, Iran, or D, China?
I'm going to go with Iran.
I didn't ask about the lowest prices.
I was way off.
Yeah, 2.3 cents a liter or 9 cents a gallon. But at least the Iranians are trying to up and up the prices because they can't afford subsidizing anymore. They're running out of money, apparently, to spill out those goodies.
I thought maybe with a closed economy that they would have some kind of a price hike, but maybe not. Okay, fine. How about the United States?
The United States, actually, is not the top performer among these. In fact, among all the developed countries, it ranks at the bottom because it has the lowest taxes. It is the 23rd lowest prices, gasoline prices, out of 170 nations around the world. And if I read you, other countries that have lower prices in that same area as the United States, Angola, Bolivia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Ecuador, the U.S. is in an astonishing neighborhood.
Well, I guess I'll go with China then.
China, indeed, according to the German research institute GIZ, is the most expensive by comparison, much more expensive than the United States, $4.20 a gallon as of last November. Here's one way where the Chinese lead the way in terms of becoming cleaner than we are, because if in a country as poor, relatively, as China is, gas prices are that high, it kind of puts a damper on driving that much, even though they still do a lot of it.
Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com, and they've got new features at The Globalist every day. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And finally, Jeremy, a study out of Europe says men who are more cultured are happier and healthier people.
Huh.
Are you happy and healthy?
I don't know if that has to do with being cultured at all. But,
well, we're
going to
find out exactly what cultured means. Researchers at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology say cultured men are generally in better health, have lower levels of depression, and are satisfied with their lives, even more so than cultured women. There's a uniqueness to this study among men.
Hmm.
So what does the study define as culture? Going to museums, galleries, and theaters often, frequently,
so that's
right?
That's what makes you happy and healthy. You don't have to. So basically, I could go out and have a few bacon cheeseburgers this afternoon and then go to an art museum and I'd be fine.
I think you would be healthy. They would not have to hook you up to an EKG after that. So how often are we talking about here that you would have to go to these theaters and galleries? Let's just say enough time to replace the hours you would be spending on the couch eating donuts and watching General Hospital.
Well, I don't watch General Hospital, but I get your point. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.